Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Hello and welcome to another Punk Rock Bowling Turned Out a Punk special episode, because Punk Rock Bowling is this week, the end of this week. I decided to switch it up and put the Punk Rock Bowling episode at the beginning of the week, plus there's going to be another Punk Rock Bowling episode kind of midweek, because I got a few more to get through before I head down myself to enjoy the fun and sun of Las Vegas and Punk Rock Bowling. But we are not slowing down in the amazing episodes, because today on the show, from the legendary UK Subhumans, from Mental, from Culture Shock, from Citizen Fish, the unbelievable, one of the greatest front people ever, Dick Lucas, is on the show today. And this is it's an awesome conversation. Starts off with me having to apologize, because they are, without a doubt, one of the greatest bands of all time. But first, to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That's run by Tristan, my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do for this show. Also, huge thank you to Mutiny PR, Christina and Vanessa, for all the help they are being for getting us all these shows organized as well. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram at LeftForDamian. There is a YouTube page, a Facebook page, a Instagram page, and a TikTok page, all of those for at Turned Out a Punk, and those can be found on those respective platforms. Support the show by telling all your friends about it, and I play in a band. We are called Fucked Up. We've got some shows coming up this summer. We've got some new releases, and you can find out more information over at fuckedup.cc. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, I start this thing off apologizing to the man, because for years, and if you're a longtime listener of this show, you know that I've always waved the flag for the Canadian Subhumans as being the ultimate Subhumans. And I still, don't get me wrong, love the Canadian Subhumans. Think they have some of the greatest punk songs ever, like Behind the Smile or Death of Sigil. They're just like, they are beyond reproach in the songwriting section of things. But when I got to see the UK Subhumans live and play with them a couple times, I realized that, no disrespect to the Canadian Subhumans, who are great live, the UK Subhumans are on a different level, like one of the greatest live bands I've ever seen. So to get Dick on the show is something I've wanted to do for a long time, because Dick's journey doesn't even start with the Subhumans. Obviously, it goes way beyond the Subhumans, the Culture Shock and Citizen Fish, but it begins like kind of just after the very first wave with the Mental. Anyway, you'll hear me talk about it all with him in one moment. Subhumans, Punk Rock Bowling, you heard it off the top. They will also be doing a East Coast tour, and they've got some European tour dates. They've got a Bandcamp page, subhumans.bandcamp.com, and you can pick up some of their releases. They are all classics. There's a real like a real starter pack worth of records you can buy that are just the Subhumans. Like the first, they never got bad. They're one of those bands that never got bad. Anyway, you'll hear this all happen in 1 second. So I got nothing more to ramble on about. Hopefully I see you down in Vegas. Let's hang out. Let's talk punk. And until then, sit back, relax, and enjoy Dick Lucas on Turned Out a Punk. Dick, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Why not? It's a lovely day for it.
As I was sparing you from this off air, I will now force you to hear it.
I think you're one of the greatest front people ever. And on some sort of twisted national pride thing, I would always argue Canadian subhumans over the UK subhumans until I saw you guys live. And yeah, you're just like one of the greatest front people I've ever seen. And it's a,
Oh, thank you.
oh, and there's a lot to talk about because I think in addition to the subhumans, in addition to Citizen Fish, in addition to Culture Shock, the Mental are one of the best fucking 7 inches of all time.
All right. No one's ever said that. This is the first. You see, if you
Really?
live, yeah, if you live long enough, everything happens.
Well, I feel honored to get to do that because, it got reissued by our, I'm sure our mutual friend Sean Forbes's
Sure.
demonstration tapes. So he must have put it over to you as being a fantastic record and like an early example of like a shift to kind of like hard punk and like and I mean this in a glowing way. It kind of might come off disparagingly, so I don't mean it this way, but like a primitive sound to
Oh yeah,
punk and
oh yeah.
hardcore.
It was primitive. The actual set, the 7-inch, I mean, Sean released that alongside the demos. But the 7-inch, we had no idea what we were doing. We were in a studio in Reading, and the sound engineer wasn't really interested. You know what I mean? He doesn't make some money doing whatever. He'd have anyone in recording, and yeah, we set up one of the songs called 18 was the only time we could get from beginning to the end of the song. So it's like, right, that's the one. Yeah, and that's what when the drums come in at the start, that they sound sort of offbeat, and we all come in at the wrong place, something like that. So it was our first time in the studio, and we didn't know anything about studios except that's where you re made recordings. And it was we stopped for lunch, and the guy says, "Okay, we'll go to a pub for lunch." So we'll go to a pub and have a few pints and just get drunk on top of it. I don't remember much about the mixing, but there wasn't much of it. Basically, yeah, that'll do was the basic premise, because we got to go home in about an hour. So yeah, that'll do. The whole thing was done in about 6 hours' time. A lot of bands were doing it that way because there was a lot of people who'd never been in bands or even musicians before. We weren't even competent musicians. We were learning as we were going along. But yeah, we were very happy to have a record out. And the DJ John Peel, he played a couple of songs off it, which was like, John Peel, yes, result, because he was the man. He was on Radio One late every weeknight for years and years and years, and he was like the only DJ for a while. He was the only DJ playing punk rock. He was the only DJ playing any style you can think of. He played it first, and he'd get letters and say, "Well, what's this rubbish you're playing? This isn't the same as Free or Eric Clapton or whatever." And he'd go, "No, this is, I like it. I'll put it on." And he's playing stuff like Teenage Jesus and the Jerks, where they're like one beat, one four chord, 1.5 minute songs shrieking away. It's like, wow, this is brilliant. So yeah, early days. I wouldn't say it's the best record ever made, but I know if we tried to re-record it again, it just wouldn't have the same feeling to it.
Yeah, there's a an honesty and a purity, and I think that's one of the greatest things about punk is because it allowed young people to kind of put out records or gave young people permission to put out records to and to make art and said like what you're doing is important. We're left with these sort of documents that are perfect. You couldn't recreate that. Like it's just like a magical time of time, like place in time.
Oh yeah, well, un unlike these digital days, records, we made 500 of them. Actually, no, what happened to it? It was supposed to be a pressing of 1,000, and only 700 made it back from the pressing plant for whatever reason. But we sold all of them. You could sell 1,000 records or 2,000 if you're lucky, like the subhumans were in Demolition War, the first 7-inch. That had pre-orders of 5,000, and these days the last subhumans LP, 40 years later, has been out for, oh crikey, too long, about 4.5 years, and it's sold 3,000. So it just goes, I mean, everything's gone digital. Everybody can just, apart from t-shirts, you can just download everything now, musically especially.
It's changed
And
completely.
It's totally changed. I'd say for the worse, because not because I'm an old git, but because I'm a git and I've always been like this. Things that are supposed to be progress, to me quite often seem regressive, because just because something more widely available, it takes away the amount of work, concentration, and energy and thought that you have to put into something to make something happen. You get a record out, you got to go through a lot of processes to get a record out. You've got to save the money, you've got to work to save the money, you've got to find someone who will put it out, or you put it out yourself. Then you've got to find a pressing plant, then you've got to get rid of them somehow by finding out distributions or setting one up or finding other people. There's a lot of communication and contact with real live people, and that's the way it happened. And it would take months and months, and now you can do a digital download and upload it and have it out there being listened to by possibly thousands of people within a week. Or even 2 days if you're lucky. But the feeling of reward and achievement just is a much shallower version of what it used to be, I think. You can download it, you can't carry it around, you can't show it to your mates, you can't look at the sleeve and devour every little detail of what's on the sleeve or read the lyrics through until you've learned off by heart, because it's all just playing in the background while you're doing whatever you do online, you know.
Well, speaking of which, I don't have the copy of the Mental 7-inch. It's quite an expensive record at this point. But when you do study that record, you see, Police killed Jay Kelly, I believe, is scrawled in one corner. There's thanks to John Peel and the UK subs. There's so much information that I gleaned from that as someone that wants to talk to you now about this stuff. There's just it just has a different value to it when it exists in physical form. And it's not even downloaded at this point, right? It's just streamed. It's not even a part of someone's life beyond the fact that you check in and check out with it. And maybe it resonates with you, maybe it doesn't, but it certainly isn't going to be studied in the same way 40 some odd years later.
No, because three-dimensional stuff has a larger impact on the human brain.
So I guess going back before that, were you listening to John Peel? I think Perfume Garden was his show in the 60s, but what he was doing radio in the early 70s as well, right?
I mean, I started listening to him round about when punk started, I think, because somebody told me you should listen to John Peel, he plays punk rock. I was listening to him slightly before, about 76, 77. I was about 15, 17, something like
What were you listening
that.
to? Oh, sorry, go on.
Wasn't it two before? Oh, a right mixture of names one doesn't drop at parties. But on the top of the list, and sort of list of names that don't make people go, ooh, you were listening to what? There was early David Bowie stuff, early Black Sabbath stuff. I mean, when I was a teenager, I was listening to the I'd listen to the charts every Sunday when they came out to see what was in the top 20. And I didn't like much of it. But that's what I was listening to. There wasn't really much. I didn't really know. There was another DJ, Alan Freeman, who was on Radio One of a Saturday afternoon. He also started playing punk rock alongside. He played a lot of rock music, some of which wasn't too bad. But he played when he played the adverts for teenagers. It had a multifaceted effect on my brain. It was like, what these this is a title for teenagers. You never seen that sort of title anywhere before. And here's some lyrics saying we're bored teenagers. We've got nothing to do and watching the rise of things, flames burning up in the night. Whatever it was, the lyrics, and it's just like it would. So that was the first thing. Lyrically, it meant something relevant. I was bored and a teenager for a start, to put it in basic terms. But I'd never, aside of a couple of Frank Zappa lyrics that I'd heard before, that was like, whoa, what's this about? You know, Frank Zappa, he was singing about plastic people way before anyone considered society as something that might not be absolutely just what there is, but yeah, something full of bullshit and plasticity and shallowness and stuff like that. Frank Zappa, he was doing that in the late 60s with the Mothers of Invention. Yes, I should have mentioned him. Well, I just did. So there you go. And then again, it was a what, like 2 minute, 10 seconds long song. So it was a lot shorter than most other songs I heard up to that point. So you had a short song, all the music, there's no lead breaks, and it was all the powerful bits of a regular song put into one song without any of the intro, the outro, the middle eight, whatever they wanted to call it in rock terms. All that was just cut out. It was just your basic chord structure with a chorus, first chorus, first chorus, first chorus, end, whatever it is. It was dead simple. It was powerful from beginning to end. It meant something, and that was my introduction to punk rock. And then the Clash come on doing Police and Thieves. I thought, is this? Is this all really? But it's kind of catchy, and it's like. Then I found out it was a cover version. Then I found out about reggae a lot more than I ever had done before, and delved into that. I liked some of it. Didn't like a lot of it, but I liked some of it. Because when you're a teenager, you kind of want things to be fast and furious more than slow and relaxed. And I hadn't smoked any weed by that point, which might have helped. Who knows?
Oh, it definitely helps. What about then, like artists like Captain Beefheart or like the Pink Fairies or stuff like that? Was that on your radar? Like, was that on the radio at all or?
I've never heard the Pink Fairies. People occasionally mention them. I really probably should delve into them a little bit. Captain Beefheart, I caught up too late, maybe because my bandmate Jasper, who's in Citizen Fish and Culture Shop, were a big fan of Captain Beefheart, so he played me a lot of them. And some of his stuff is excellently, really just out there completely. Some of his music is a bit too funky for my liking, but some of it, just the word-wise, the lyrics, they're just crazy, surreal images. I like that stuff.
So, like, because it's interesting the stuff that was happening in the UK prior to punk, like, Dr. Feelgood, like Pink Fairies, even like bands like the Groundhogs, like, there was like this sort of bubbling up that seemed to be happening, but like, it really kind of coalesces, obviously, when punk really hits. Do you remember the first time you heard the word punk?
Oh. Nope. No, I have no, I don't know if I read it or heard it or.
Was it on like the radio? Was it on the NME as or like were like you into the music papers by that point? Like, because it kind of hit with a little bit of like media, like I
Oh, I had
guess.
a whole bunch of media attention. The music papers, I mean, when punk was going, roughly the same time as that started, I started buying NME and Sounds. And I used to be by Melody Maker, but that was just a bit too up his own ass, whatever. It was still mostly about rock music and had a little bit of punk rock in it. But Enemy and Sounds were full on into the whole punk thing. Enemy was more intelligent about it, more in depth about the stuff that punks were singing about. They had like semi-political articles in them now and again. Sounds was way more into the music and the fashion and the look of it, but it was all full of interviews with your favorite punk bands and reviews of records in case you wondered what was the next one you were going to seek out. And at the back, a whole bunch of adverts for bootleg tapes until they made that illegal. The original version of what became Blurg Tapes, which before it was Blurg Records, was what I called my electric list, which was a bunch of bootleg tapes that I would swap for other bootleg tapes. I mean, I bought a couple and then copy them and swap them with other people via these classified ads in the back of Sounds and NME. And I still got a collection of all. They sound atrocious. And of course, every time you copy one, they sound a little bit worse. So some of these were like, 50th generation tapes on really crap cassettes. But you could listen to the Sex Pistols playing in Finland or Stockholm or Manchester or whatever. You didn't go to these gigs because it was all over by the time you found out about it. But you could hear them on tape. And a few of them are actually still quite listenable. That's the word. But people were collecting. I was collecting them. And I started selling them. I didn't sell many. I swapped loads. And swapped a few for the chap in Scotland who I met again the other day after 40 odd years disappearance. It was pretty crazy. He used to send me signed punk albums and swap a signed punk album, but Damned or the Clash or whatever, for like five tapes. Good deal. But now I've got a copy of Give Them Enough Rope with like the whole class signatures all over it. You look at it, it's probably worth £500. That's my pension sorted out.
I think £500 easy. The mental 7 inches worth close to that at this point.
Well, no, you're not. No, I think that's ridiculous. I think there should be a limit on the amount that there is a limit on the amount people will pay. That whoever pays hundreds of pounds for a record, I don't know. I wouldn't. People do. I've never actually sold a record for. Well, I don't sell any of my records. I've got way too many, but that don't matter. The other day, I saw on eBay. This one bugs me a lot. Of all the things that bug me about stuff I'm connected to being sold on eBay or whatever for large prices, there's a guy out there. He's got two letters that I wrote in the mid 80s. And he said, I wrote to, you know, two individual people, not it wasn't a general handout or anything, it was a handwritten letter. And it's a picture of it, you know, a scan of it on the eBay page. I should actually get onto it about it. I'm not sure what I'm going to say, but he's selling that for £400. And it's like, no, in so many levels, this is so wrong. Firstly, on the obvious level, it's a personal letter I wrote to somebody, it's their letter. Whether that is the person who's sending them, I don't know. If it was, if the person I wrote to is selling that letter, then it's a bit less offensive. It'd be way more less offensive indeed if he put it there, sell it for a penny, and see if he gets anybody offering more money for it. In which case, he's not so much the culprit as a bit of a, you know, winging it entrepreneur or whatever. But somebody starting the price at over £400, so that is just exploitation. On the basis that I'm now apparently famous enough to sell my fucking letters to people from fucking umpteen years ago. I found that scary, ridiculous, and embarrassing. Don't do that, please.
Well, I guess this is the inverse side of the coin of these things becoming artifacts, is the fact that these things do become so cherished that people are willing to pay ridiculous prices for some of this stuff.
All I've got to do is afford the cost of a stamp, write me a letter, ask me to reply, telling them what they want to know about, and I will write them back. And then they've got their own personal fucking letter, and it costs them less than a dollar, right? Not £400. So it must be the age of the thing. There's things that last a long time apparently are worth more because they've lasted a long time. I get that, but it's still offensive that that should be. It's just stupid and ridiculous that that should be worth having. Anyway, moving on.
It's funny you bring this up because Billy Bragg was just on the podcast with my friend George Pettit, who sings in this band Alexis on Fire. And the idea of bringing them together came about because years ago, George had found a copy of the New Burnett 12-inch at Amoeba Records. And inside was a letter Billy had written to a friend of his with his top 10 Elvis Costello records listed.
All
And
right.
so we had this conversation with Billy and we pull out this letter and he's like, wow. And we're just, it's interesting how these things that you write that are obviously a personal letter to someone, so not to undercut that, but they end up becoming significant to people completely removed from that conversation. As, and now this is obviously way crasser when you're selling it for £400 or, but like they become an entry point to something you're fascinated by, this person's music.
I guess it does, yeah.
Going back to kind of the start of things, what was the first punk concert you remember attending?
Oh, that was a free gig, 7 miles away. My dad gave me a lift. I wasn't driving at the time. In a town called Devizes in Wiltshire. And it was alternative TV, Here and Now, The Mob, who were a local band, and a couple of other bands. I don't remember who it was. But it was a free gig. They were doing a free tour, Here and Now and ATV. I read years later that it lost them loads of money and the whole concept didn't work. It was a pass the hat round thing. There was loads of flashing lights and smoke and stuff in the air, and it was all very loud, and I was just bewildered completely. My mate who came with me, he took one look in the door and just walked home. He walked home 7 miles. And at that point, he didn't become a punk rocker. And I more or less did. Well, I was already, but that was it. I was, yeah. It was scary, weird, loud, just really an odd experience. But that was my first punk rock gig. That's my second gig ever, I think.
Alternative TV seem like a band that is kind of like a birth of DIY type band punk, like where punk was like the first wave of bands were signing to major labels. They seemed like they were definitely pursuing one path of doing this thing, but then there's sort of this new path that emerges, and obviously you guys are huge champions of it for a very long time. But Alternative TV seems like one of the early bands to kind of, obviously they're doing like a free tour.
They definitely were. I mean, they doing this free tour. Mark Perry, the singer, he did a Sniffing Glue fanzine, which is like one of the first fanzines that wasn't a magazine. You know, it wasn't on the shelves. And if you listen to the first ATV album, they've got the insane idea of starting the album with a couple of live songs that are more or less jams in between actual songs, where he's talking to the crowd and telling them how stupid they are. Oh, I'll give you this space, and all you want to do is fight. And it's like, that's the first song on their first album. It's like, they're definitely not doing it for corporate reasons. You know, there's no sort of, okay, our greatest hit is going to be this song. We'll put that on the front. That'll be the single from the album, side one, track one, get people into it, get DJs in it. It's like, nah, none of that nonsense. Let's put a live thing in there where we talk to the crowd. Like, superb. It's the opposite of trying to make it. It's just like, this is what we do. This is what we're about. And all their songs, there was a remarkable amount of variety in their songs. It's not like you're going to mistake one for the next.
And that to me is like the birth of punk, right? Because that's when it becomes not about being in service necessarily to the music industry. And success can come, but you're not chasing success. You're doing this in service of punk in a way. Like there's you're doing it for this thing that's greater than yourself and greater than success.
It's just the newfound ability to be able to do something that you previously thought was way out of your league, you know, either in terms of cost or connections to record labels. You know, nobody knew anything about putting out records until you just sort of start going for the telephone directory and find out, okay, press implants, let's find one, see how much it actually costs to make 200 records or whatever. But the inspiration to do that came from the very nature of punk rock. Even though the big punk bands like the Pistols, the Clash of Damn, they were all on more or less major labels. On the other hand, you got Stiff Records. That was an independent label. Just it got bigger because they sold a whole bunch of Damned records and various other artists.
And I guess Chiswick too.
Yeah, I mean, the Damned were hopping around between labels, and there was a lot of independent labels. Before the very much smaller ones, so we were just a small, our record label for the Mental Kamikaze Pig Records. Think of a name, stick it on the label. That's the only thing we ever released. That was just a small version of excuse me, any other label.
But it's the idea of like anyone can do this, like you're saying, that becomes revolutionary to this thing. And I've heard legend of this, but like John Peel playing the Desperate Bicycles 7-inch, and obviously the Desperate Bicycles on that first 7-inch saying it's cheap, it's easy, go do it, being
Yeah.
kind of like a rallying cry. Like, were they on your radar at all?
In the background radar, yeah. I didn't hear much by him. I mean, John Peel played a lot by a lot of bands. And I taped quite a lot of his shows and then reduced those tapes down to the bits that I liked. They had like John Peel sessions and that sort of thing. I mean, I could dig out a couple of tapes and reel off a whole bunch of names, but that would be a bit tedious.
That's my dream. Anytime you want to do that, we don't have to do that now, but anytime you want to just go through your record collection, your tape collection, including the tapes that you kind of like, I guess pre-Blurg, pre-Kamikaze Pig, were kind of putting out on a label, the bootleg tapes.
Oh, those. Yeah, they were all, that was all like Clash, Banshees, Pistols, a couple of Stranglers ones. And then a bunch of Stooges ones. Not so much tapes as bootleg records. That's the tape when there were regular record fairs in Bath, where I am now. That was like the big city near to where I was living. And every month or so, there'd be a record fair. You go there, and some people would have like a whole bunch of bootlegs, vinyl ones, going for about £10, which is when regular albums cost about £3. So they weren't cheap. But yeah, I bought a few Stooges ones and a few Banshees ones, a few Pistols ones there, the vinyl versions, which were obviously much decenter, much more decent recordings than these tapes.
I guess that. Oh, go on, sorry.
Sorry, I was just actually lost on what the question was that preceded the answer.
Oh no, just the stuff that you were kind of had on your list in the back of the NME.
Oh, yeah, it was just those tapes. And then, that was it. I started taking like one of these chunky cassette recorders, you know, press play and record at the same time, and a microphone. And I take those to, I took them to a couple of gigs. There was a members gig in Camberley. I was visiting a mate who lived there, and the members were playing. I think that's why I went to visit. And in those days, you could just take a tape player into a gig and no one would stop you, I guess, because that's what I did. Put it at the back of the hall on a chair somewhere, press play and record while they were playing. And most of the time, the very volume would just be too much for the mic and it'd just be all distorted to hell, which is a shame. The only recordings I've got of mental gigs are of the distorted to hell type, which is terrible, really. This one's called something. You can hear that bit, and then like, damn it. But so I got a couple of good tapes. The members tape was good. I recorded the Upstarts playing, Angelic Upstarts playing Trowbridge in 1980 or 79 or 80, whichever it was. That didn't come out too well. Coincidentally, that was the time when I first met Bruce and Julian, who at the time were in the Stupid Humans, which is the band that preceded Subhumans. They were in Stupid Humans, were going at the same time as the Mental Work. We did a couple of gigs together. That's when I first met the local punks from nearby towns and the bands they were in. But it did seem like a lot of people were in bands at the same stage as we were, just being inventive and just making up stuff and doing a gig every now and again when we could get one.
I guess that's also be the beginning of sort of like the true sort of second wave of bands starting. Like after that first wave of punk bands, the initial kind of explosion, it's like the DIY thing and bands putting out tapes. I guess a younger generation too.
Slightly younger, yeah. But yeah, I mean, the Enemy and Sound, well, the Enemy especially, and Melody Maker were saying punk was dead shortly after Sid Vicious died, around about then, like mid 79 to then. That's it, punk. Yeah, we've had enough out of punk rock. We've squeezed the sponge that was punk rock. We've got all we can get out of it. For everything else from now on is just copying what happened in the first place. And so we were in the, shall we call it, the next generation of punk bands who weren't getting the attention from the press whatsoever, even if we bothered to write to them or tell them about we had a new record out or whatever. It might get mentioned, it probably wouldn't. Having said that, there were occasionally journalists like Winston Smith from Sounds who caught onto the Subhumans and did two interviews with us for Sounds. And the first one had a was the Sounds, it was the first ever color front cover of the magazine Sounds, and it was a picture of us on stage. It's like, oh wow, first color one, blimey, with a two-page thing in it. Just yeah, that was pretty something else. So we weren't completely off the radar, but generally to the general public, punk had come and gone and new wave had taken over, and then Mark Oldman and all that stuff was starting to go get big, and it all became very disco-y, new wavy, and you know, the Banshees went a bit more commercial. Human League, who were kind of a weird punk band, went utterly commercial and then started to make loads of money and went wherever they went. Things developed like that. A lot of bands that were initially just they're punk bands because they're new and they look weird, playing all sorts of music. I mean, the variety went all the way from the Toy Dolls to Wire, put it that way. I mean, any sort of music was labeled punk initially if they were on a, how was that judged? If I was going to say if they're on a small label, but why were on like EMI or something, you know, some So I don't know if it would judge to be punk bands or not. If they were new and they actually said they were a punk band, that probably carried it enough weight. But after a few years, journalists especially would divide these bands up into punk, pop punk, new wave, third generation. Then Oi came along, and then crass bands came along with via Gary Bushell doing his split everybody up into labels and pigeonholes. And the whole cohesion, such as it was, not very much of it, that said, all these bands are punk rock, let's go buy all these records, and like 9 out of 10 would be good enough to keep playing.
It kind of sets up, I guess, the pattern that seems to follow, where anytime you get some sort of punk resurgence, punk kickoff again in popular culture, there'll come a point where it just factions off into all these different scenes. And that's when it gets really interesting to me is the period you're talking about, where maybe the press isn't covering it as much, but there are all these new mutations and yeah, like categorizing them obviously had huge negative ramifications, but the fact that all these different people were taking it in all these different directions, where you have new wave of British heavy metal and ska happening in one point, but you also and two-tone, I guess, ska happening, but then you also have, as you're saying, crass, you have Oi, you have bands that are just kind of trying, I guess, follow where I guess the jam's going, we're more power poppy kind of direction, but it feels like there's a well, there's a huge explosion in the wake of punk being, as you said, dead.
Yeah, so many bands were influenced by the nature of punk rock, either the appearance or the music, probably less the music, because the music bands influenced by punk included all sorts of pop bands, synthesizer bands, metal bands, all sorts. And that's a great thing. You know, these days you've got grannies walking around with green hair. I say if it wasn't for punk rock, that would never have happened.
100%. And there's a part in that, there's a part in that movie, Punk's Not Dead, from like way back when, 2007. And you're talking, they're driving around with you in a van, and you're talking about rockabillies and making fun of the rockabillies as they're going into a bar. And you're saying how like it's funny how punk's kind of become that same sort of thing. But I think what makes punk special is the fact that it kept evolving. Like that rockabilly scene, I guess there are some, you know, psychobilly kind of things happening afterwards, but it seems very much like something that's always hearkening back, where punk feels like it's truly organic and it's always changing, it's always reassessing, and it's always revitalizing itself because it's always giving a new wave of 15, 16, 17-year-old kids permission to
And
kind of make their own.
that's because the basic reason for that, I think, is, you know, the 15, 16 year olds are getting into playing punk rock because that is what comes out when you've got people who can't play playing together. What comes out is punk rock because it's basic, it's unformulated, it's exciting to those playing it. It's exciting to people hearing it if they like that sort of thing. A lot of people do because it's got that rawness and the ingenuity. And even bands trying to do copies of their favorite bands will not sound like those bands. They will sound like themselves trying to copy it, but with just a little twist somewhere, that will be its own sound, and they'll have their own sound to present to people. I'm generalizing because this is what you got to do. But that, I mean, basic 4-beat music that it, mostly non-electronic music. What I'm saying is like not with synthesizers and that sort of thing. Obviously, guitar, electric guitars, yada yada. But let's rephrase that. Music was your basic, you know, drums, bass, guitar, vocals. With maybe a couple of added extra, probably not. It is basically that's your rock and roll. You speed it up, and you're not very good at it. Then it becomes punk because rock and roll is supposed to be at least efficient in tuning and that sort of thing. I've seen bands that can't play with so much energy and enthusiasm. It's just like, yes, this is wonderful. And when they get better, they might not actually be as good as this.
Yeah.
You know, but that is your basic punk rock. It's like, it's an inability that's thrown out the window and replaced by drive and enthusiasm. The ability comes later on.
And like you said earlier, message too. Like bands were saying something, even if it's just like we're bored teenagers, they weren't saying we're happy, everything's fine, putting on a smile as things aren't fine for them. And I think that's
No.
the, and that's the, well, and that's, I think, what makes this stuff so timeless. And what resonates still is, like, when you listen to it, it's still an honest expression by a person of their feelings, and that's way more important to me than virtuosity.
Yeah, totally. It's the teenagers especially need an outlet for expression. They need somewhere where they can just vent their feelings without turning to drugs or violence. And punk rock is a very good outlet. Singing, especially, is, I think, it makes you live longer and it's good for the soul.
Well, especially the type of vocal that you do, and you're one of the first people doing this type of vocal, which I'm obviously very much following in your footsteps with.
Well, what is my type of vocal?
Harsh vocal. Like, and it's so, it's funny because I was just writing about this the other day, in regards to Leatherface and sort of that his approach to vocals as well, like Frankie's approach to vocals, because, like, it's not like any traditional vocal, which is about control and it's about locking in with the rhythm. It's about finding a place in music. I think what you're doing, and I don't mean to speak for you on this, but I mean, like, to me, what it's doing is saying emotion and obviously the passion, the lyrics, that's the most important thing. And other stuff is important and has to be in there, and melody and finding all those things within that. But, like, what it's really about is a raw expression of real emotion.
Yeah, and I should add, over the years, the actual nature of the singing, in terms of hitting the notes and holding the notes, gets better. You know, the more you do something, you're going to get better at it. So it's less shouty these days because I can hit the notes I was missing when I was a teenager, or whatever. You know, I try to do. I really wanted to do a good shriek because Iggy Pop was has some fantastic shrieks. What song was it? It might have been TVI. Anyway, it doesn't matter. And I want to do one of those shrieks in one of the songs on Demolition War. And I just couldn't hit the note. It comes out as a, hey!
Well, as you're saying, like, the technique comes with time, but there's still that, the thing about your vocals this day, like seeing it live, hearing the records you're doing, it's still like that, this is a real emotion that you're putting out there, and that's timeless. That's why the mental stuff still sounds fucking awesome to this day, and your vocals still sound wicked on that, because it still hits, you still feel it.
Yeah, it's also before I knew how to sing, so to speak. It just it's it, it that is your primal shouting, more or less on the right note. But, you know, no experience of doing it much before, except that practices or whatever. But that's that primal thing that you've got when you first start doing something.
And you hear it on old early rock and roll records too. Like, the harsh vocal certainly wasn't invented by punk. You hear it on gospel recordings, you hear it on old blues recordings, you hear, like, there's like this tradition of just emoting and hitting that point where the melody, the song, everything else is almost secondary to that vocal. Like you're saying, that shriek that Iggy Pop would do on those songs too, where it's like, that's not necessarily in service to the song, as it's more in service to, like, having to let that out, having to get that out.
Yeah, it's pure wordless expression.
I also find it interesting. Oh, go on.
Excuse me,
Please.
I've got to blow my nose.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
Oh, that's better. It's the first cold I've had in like, I've lost count, 10, 15 years. I've not had one cold whatsoever. I've had this one for 5 weeks.
Well, Vegas will clear you out.
Yeah, maybe.
Try out Vegas and everything. And legal cannabis there too. So it's really the fun Sin City now.
Right. If that doesn't help me cold, at least I'll feel better about it.
Yeah, dabs. If dab doesn't clear out the sinus cavity, I don't know what will. I found it fascinating that you did all these live recordings too, because so much of Blurred Tapes early on is live recordings of bands, and not just, you know, your stuff, but like other bands that you're recording too, like Wild Youth and
stuff. Yeah, I mean, it started off just being local bands like Wild Youth, Organized Chaos, the A-Heads, and then saw the Instigators on tour and blown away by them. So I just started taking the tape recorder with me and recording occasional support bands, and then just asked them if they've got any live tapes they want to put out on Blurg, and some said yes.
It also around this time, it feel, well, just from reading stuff, it seems like this is the beginning of kind of, we talked about Oi, but the sort of right-wing insurgency into punk music that begins with, I guess it starts in Leeds and begins spreading. You hear a lot of stuff about early Poison Girls shows and mob shows getting attacked by National Front kind of skinheads.
Yes, there were some venues, a couple in London especially, one called Skunks, where the skinheads would go to on a regular basis, and they would almost enjoy having a go at the punks who turned up, especially ones who played in like left-leaning bands or anarcho bands, as the label went, or the label was Crass Bands. It was like Crass Bands and Oi Bands. Started to exist on a different plane of existence because at the insistence of Gary Bushell, a journalist who started a couple of bands himself, nothing against him, except the nature of what he was writing was saying that Crass Bands and Oi Bands were just, they were so never the two shall meet sort of thing. I mean, he actually liked Crass to start with, but then Crass refused to do an interview with him and then he got really pissed off. That's why Crass wrote that song about him. I forgot what it's called now. Come on, hurry up, Gary, come on. So, but yeah, these skinheads, they were a pain in the ass. They were trouble. They spray painted a van that we had a mate drive us to a gig up there once in, spraying swastikas around and that sort of shit. They just really ruined quite a lot of gigs. Time passed. They fucked off somewhere else, got into whatever, or they grew up or grew their hair or lost their hair. And now every time I see skinheads at, say, the Rebellion Festival, who are like off the age of 50 or what's even 60 these days, I think, right, are you a skinhead like because you've always have been? Are you a skinhead because your hair fell out? And if you've always been a skinhead, were you one of those people who would have attacked us 40 years ago and just mellowed out? And there's, you just don't know, and you don't go asking in case you find out. You know, you don't want to cause ripples where there's none anymore. The whole thing's much less violent. There's hardly any violence left there. People don't steal things from the stall. There's less theft. There's less violence. There's less anxiety and nervousness about punk gigs. There's much more feeling of like equality and relaxation and a fired upness, which has always been in punk rock, that leads to more to positive things like conversation and idea swapping rather than leading to excluding this person because they're not as fired up as you, or they're wearing they got the wrong dress code, dress sense or whatever. That's a good thing. And young kids are still coming to punk rock gigs, most of them influenced by their parents' or uncles' record collection, which is great. It's amazing. It's 2024. It's like, what? And it's like these young kiddies are coming and they know the lyrics. Not all the time. And there was a whole swathe of decades where we were taking our audience with us, so to speak. So they were 20 when we were 20. And now we're like approaching 60, or actually are 60. The older you get, the harder it is to admit it. Ah, I'm 4,000 years old. Oh, how dare you admit that sort of thing. So A lot of our crowd has stayed with us, which is great. But up to recently, when I say recently, the last 5 years, or whatever, the average age of our crowd in the UK was probably the same age as we were, or a bit less, you know, 30, 40, 45. These days it's going back down to the average age, becoming 25 to 30 again. Do these things matter? Yes, it does, because young people bring a whole bunch of energy to a gig. And it also feels like you're not just preaching to the converted, to put it in its most negative sense. I mean, you know, you're singing songs to people who you know like them because you saw them last year and a decade ago. They're still around. Of course they like it. We've got new faces turning up of you turning up and enjoying it and getting into it and singing along. It's like, blimey, you know the lyrics. Fantastic. It replicates the original feeling. It keeps you going. It re-energizes. And that's what keeps punk rock going. That's what keeps bands going. People say, oh, how come you keep going after all these years? I said, because you keep turning up. If you stayed at home and nobody came out, we would just say, well, this is fucked, isn't it? And go off and write novels or paint houses. I don't know what we do.
And it also stops it from being that rockabilly scene that you talked about in that documentary, where it's people going and just reenacting something that was. This is going to be something that outlives us. And that's what is so great, because it's something that was.
There are still rockabilly bands around, and no doubt doing their own versions of the old style of rockabilly. I know next to nothing about it. I saw one playing locally, and I think it was rockabilly. It was dead good. All the twanging guitar and all that.
I don't mean to beat up on rockabilly, but I mean like it could be any type of music where it doesn't necessarily have that next generation of kids that are taking it into a different place, but still somehow part of it, where it's all like you look at any of these festivals, you know, Punk Rock Bowling, or you look at Rebellion, there's always these younger bands that are doing things that are slightly different, but they're still part of this thing. There's something that's like a lineage that goes all the way back to, well, I guess alternative TV.
I mean, I'd hazard a guess that any scene you can think of, rockabilly, or any label we chuck to the music, if you spoke to somebody who was totally into it, they would totally say, whoa, you think you got some sort of monopoly on this thing? No. This is exactly what's going on with rockabilly. You've got this list of bands here who are influenced by this list of bands who are influenced by this lot. And it all goes back ages. And here's the parents and here's the kids. They're doing the same thing, slightly different. I mean, surely this must happen in any music scene that still exists. There has to be development and evolution within it, despite it playing what everybody outside of the scene thinks of as just the same old music. But to the people inside the scene, there's differences that means it is still fresh and reverberating.
But I would bet most of those rockabilly people that would be on that person's list started in punk bands.
Came out of punk. Ooh. We need someone to ask about this.
We got to call in the Rockabilly Authority on this thing. I feel out of my depth, but going back to sort of the unfortunate topic that we were talking about before, from doing this podcast, I find it interesting that talking to the Go-Go's, talking to people that were around sort of the early two-tone scene, it seems like a lot of the people that would wind up being these really hateful Nazi skinheads started in two-tone. Shows started going into two-tone scenes, and had to be. Billy Bragg was talking about how they eventually had to ban skinheads at all two-tone shows because there was just so many boneheads, I guess proto boneheads, showing up.
Yeah, that's the crazy thing about it, because later on, mid-80s was it when it was the positive skinhead scene came out. There's a name for them.
Rock Against Racism, or the Sharps.
Sharp, that's it. Sharp Skins. Yes. I can't put a date on when they start. I'm saying mid-80s, might have been the 90s. But, I mean, they were the positive side of skinhead-ism, and they were all very much into the two-tone, and they knew all the history of two-tone. They were well into it. And they said, look, we're positive. We're against racial prejudice. This is us. We are skinheads, but we are not the skinheads. We are ourselves. And they did a whole favour for the nature of skinheadism. Is it an ism? that hadn't existed before. But yeah, these violent skinheads, they were way into their two-tone music, and slightly into their punk rock, depending what sort of punk rock it was, or they didn't like the punks, or they did like the punks. Who knows? There was a lot of confusion going on.
It
And
definitely. Hold on.
confusion comes out in young people who shave their heads. There's a lot, teenagers who shave their heads and get into looking like a skinhead because their mates are or their big brother is. There's a lot of confusion in there. They're not sure, quite sure what they like. There's a lot of peer pressure in that scene. There's a lot of macho bullshit in that scene. So they've got to end up acting like they are not inside. Inside, I'm sure there's a lot of confused people who, given different circumstances, would have turned out a lot more friendly and sociable, but they turned out to be unfriendly and antisocial because that was the scene that they ended up in because of the nature of friendship and cajolement and peer pressure, which it's the luck of the draw, depends who you hang out with and who you live with and all sorts.
Yeah, like look at that documentary that came about Nicky Crane, the head of Screwdriver Security, where not to excuse any of the violence he committed against other people, but here's this gay kid in the closet, very confused, and once again, not to excuse what he did, but clearly there was some shit inside his head that was tormenting him, and he was living this double life at the same time, like he was not a well person.
No, that was a classic example of the nature of the confusion. You one thing on the inside that's unacceptable on the outside, so you adapt to what the outside wants, and you lose yourself, and then you get bitter and twisted and turn violent, and try to find reward and praise from being negative from other people who are doing the same thing.
And then it kills itself off, that scene. Like that's the thing with a lot of these super violent scenes. It just ruins a lot of the punk scene and just destroys even the bands that aren't necessarily on side with the fascism or the right-wing politics. But it just seems like from talking to bands that were kind of around at that time, that it just wipes it out a little bit in England for a while. Or drives it more underground, I should say. Not wipes it out.
Possibly. There's a lot of oi bands who got very popular indeed, but they wouldn't touch the right wing stuff at all. Not in their lyrics, not in their friendships, but they were still tagged with the same brush because they were in the oi scene. It was a real shame, but it didn't stop them becoming popular and selling a whole bunch of records and getting hundreds of people turn up at their shows, even decades later. So, yeah, there were bands in the oi scene fighting back against this right-wing infiltration.
Well, they're definitely like
I
red bands too, right? Like Red London, and like they're—I don't mean red in a negative way, obviously, but I mean they're left-wing oi bands the whole way through as well.
Yeah.
But you guys obviously keep it going, and well, I guess there's a point where Culture Shock—you guys stop doing Subhumans and you do Culture Shock for a while, and then you take a break for a couple years before Citizen Fish. Or is there a break now?
Well, let's see. So people stopped in, more or less stopped gigging at the start of 86, which is when I was asked to join what became Culture Shock. And at that point, Bruce went off and formed a band called Switch, which didn't really get any fun. They did a demo tape, but that was about it. Shotsky, the drummer, he was off drumming for various bands from here and there. That was Culture Shock. That lasted from 86 to 89. Then me and Jasper from Culture Shock started up Citizen Fish. And then later on in 98, Subhumans reformed. And then way later on in 2012, Culture Shock reformed. So, I mean, I've been doing this continuously, whereas members of the Subhumans stopped in 86, and Phil and Trotsky joined Citizen Fish in 89 or 90. Citizen Fish weren't doing much in the first 6 months except inventing songs, and then we started doing our gigs, and then we did literally hundreds of gigs in the next 8, 10, 12 years, whatever it was. We were averaging about 80 gigs a year or something crazy.
Because you guys, are going into the 90s, obviously the 90s po like next punk explosion that kind of happens. With Citizen Fish, was there ever any offers beyond like sort of towards major labels that came floating towards you? Like, were there any opportunities to kind of like try and
No.
pursue that commercial path?
No. None of the bands have ever been approached by a label.
It's fascinating too, because like it's like the these bands continue to sell records. Like punk bands are selling more records probably than most of these like failed attempt at major label commercial bands that have come and gone, maybe a Top of the Pops one week and forgotten the next.
Yeah. Well, these days, no matter what label you're on, it's all digital. The information's all out there. The amount of clout that large labels have got has been reduced in terms of the ratio of the clout ratio, I've now called it, between big and small, is there's much less of a gap between them. That's the dumbest sentence I've said this interview.
No, it makes sense.
It was the clout ratio that did it. That's when we turned
That's
off. That was it. Too much.
that punk rock math, and that's the only math I really understand. So I get the whole clout ratio thing the whole way through. Was there much connection during sort of the first Subhumans chapter and in this stuff that was happening in Europe at the time? Like a mainland Europe, I mean?
Well, connections, yes. Well, not much. We'd never gone abroad for the first few couple of years. And then we got for our first overseas gigs were in Holland. A couple of gigs in 80, 83, I think. Might have been 84.
Was that with like Jesus and the Gospel Fuckers or
No.
Agent Orange or trying to think of some of the other Dutch bands from around that time period. Funeral
I
Arrangements, I
see.
guess. Yeah.
I could look this up because Ian Glasper brought a book out, and in the back of that, I put this long list of all the gigs we've ever done, all the support bands we ever played with. It came out last year. It's called Silence Is No Reaction, 40 Years with the Subhumans.
Oh, I got to get this book. I will plug this in the intro and order it promptly as soon as we get off this interview.
Yeah, good one. It's on PM Press, so they are distributing it in the US. Yeah, it's a 600-page book. He just interviewed all of us and people we haven't seen for years about the band. And I've been a bit of a nerd. I've been writing down all the gigs and who turned up and who we played with and all the songs that we played since the year dot. So I managed to put all this info, apart from the set list, in the back of the book in a gigography. As like, I think it's like 1,200, our first 1,200 gigs. So I could look that up now and tell you what bands we were playing with in Holland in 1983, if it was 83. It's a good job it's all written down somewhere because our brains are just too small to handle all this info.
What was it like going to Europe and kind of witnessing like the squat scene there? I guess you were kind of tapped into, which is the punk scene that eventually when I start touring Europe, we were still tapped into. Like it's an amazing kind of outgrowth of this thing.
Yeah, I mean there were a few squatted places in the UK, but the fact is, they were way more organized with squats and free festivals and that sort of thing, and a really cohesive scene that kept it together. It wasn't just a punk scene, it was like a squatter scene that had a bunch of punks in it, that the punks were attracted to the squat scene. The squatters over there were very organized, they knew the law, and the law was frequently less oppressive than it is over here when it comes to squats. A squat over here they couldn't really last very long because they would just get closed down. But over there, they were very together. They still are. I mean, some of them have gone legal by they started to pay rent to the local authorities in order to not be shut down. They were given a choice. You either close up, move out, or you start paying rent. And a lot of them have done that, but they kept the very nature of the beast, which is DIY to the max. We'd never been fed food at gigs before, like bands being actually fed. And some of the places had bunk beds that the band could sleep in. So you go to the gig, you play, you get fed, you get drunk because they got a bar there. They give you free drinks, and then they'll put you up in a bed, and just like total It's like a family reunion. You don't know anybody there much, but they'll treat you like you were their best mates, and they'll put you up and they'll feed you, and they've got it all organized. And the next day or the next weekend, they'll do the same again for any other band that comes through. That is a beautifully DIY, perfect way to do punk rock shows. That sort of thing has taken years and hasn't really evolved into much anything similar where you are or where I am right now. Not sure why that is. There's examples of places that do that sort of thing, but I haven't found any venues over here that actually put bands up to sleep. But it's the way it goes. But yeah, Holland and Germany, especially, and France as well, and Italy, and to a lesser extent, any other European country will do the same thing. They'll put bands up and they'll feed them, and they know exactly what they're doing, and they're very good cooks as well.
Yeah, like I can only think of maybe one venue that I've been to that had a sleep place in America. And it's interesting because it is something that's very unique to, I guess, mainland Europe, because you don't see it in Australia. I haven't seen it in any of sort of the South American touring that I've done, very limited South American touring that I've done, or certainly in Japan or China. It seems like it's just something that it's such a natural idea too. Like the band's going to need a place to stay. They're going to need to eat. Why not just provide that and integrate those costs into just the venue and save the costs ultimately?
Oh, hang on. There is a place. It's going through my head right now. Where is it? Edinburgh. There you go. A venue called Bannerman's, who unfortunately just changed ownership. And the owner doesn't like punk rock, so that's gone out the window.
Oh.
And it's not a squat, it's a pub. But they do put people upstairs in bunk beds. Bannerman's in Edinburgh. And if they put on punk bands, it would help. Never mind, things change.
And I think I've definitely played a couple pubs where they said you could sleep on the floor afterwards at
Well, that's
the
nice.
end of the night. Going back to sort of that first European kind of touring and beyond sort of like playing in Holland, was there like a push to kind of tour there more as things were getting more and more violent in the UK?
Not for that reason. No, the push was. It was more of a pull, really. People wanted us to play over there. And people say, I can organize this amount of gigs. These are the dates. Can you do it? And like, hey, we're young. We haven't got any kids. We haven't got any jobs. Yes, we can do it. So we do it. And there'd be people who just, they phone ahead to various places in their own languages and sort these gigs out and say, like, I've got you these gigs. The nature of how much we were getting paid didn't come into it until we got paid something at the end of the night. We have to sort out the ferry to get to where we're going to start off the tour, and we'd hitch up with. It was a Citizen Fish tour round Europe. We went all the way to Hungary and Czechoslovakia, all sorts of places. But mostly Germany and Denmark, set up by a band called Charter 77 from Sweden.
Great band.
Yeah, that was like 90 or 91, and they organised it. A friend of theirs drove us around in their van. It was wonderful. Just all make new friends, go to different places. There was no worry about contracts or gear. We just share the gear. Everything was just pretty well basically set up on the love of doing it and not really minding if anything went wrong, just hoping it didn't. You know, vans would break down. And there was one gig in Freiburg in Germany, where we played a show in a place next door to a squat, and the whole front for the gig was to get people into one space. So after the gig, they'd all go next door to the squat and defend it and stop it being closed down because it was due to be closed down. And so we all go into the squat next door after the gig. The riot police turn up, and out the front there's petrol bombs and stuff being thrown around. There's tear gas galore. We're thinking, shit, we've got to get the gear out to the van somehow. Do we get arrested? No, let's try not to get arrested. Okay. So we go and like stay by the gear, and the riot cops get their way into the building eventually and come storming into the playing bit. And it's like, we are dumb English people. We are the band. We don't know what we're doing. Okay, fuck off. But yeah, certainly sometimes there'd be mad stuff going on.
Oh man. How much disruption was there, or how did things change post Nirvana in England? Because a lot of bands talk about how culturally things shifted, even for punk bands, in the wake of Nirvana kind of blowing up in America.
Really? Okay, I've never actually heard about this
Good and bad too. Well, because I think,
time split before and after Nirvana.
it definitely seems like something that is, it was a big thing in, I guess, 91, 1990 for
I guess the
bands.
whole, yeah, I think the whole Seattle scene, the music coming out of Seattle in that at that time was influencing a lot of bands over here. There was a lot of it on the jukeboxes in pubs and that sort of thing. They were popular beyond your usual punk band popularity.
Even I guess beyond the sonic influence of it, just the way it changed touring, there was like a lot more emphasis put on what was happening underground. There was a lot more major labels sniffing around in some cases. There was a lot more record sales, a lot more press attention for punk, and it really does seem like it was a
Yeah,
cultural
I
shift,
guess.
good and bad, in America.
Yeah, I guess between Nirvana and Rancid and Bad Religion, they up the awareness potential of journalists and the general public towards the fact punk rock was like still going on, and for a lot of people, becoming more listenable because it was like a version of pop punk basically, or heavy pop punk, whatever you want to call it. So yeah, it grabbed a lot of people's attention. And it fired up the punk scene into like the pro or anti Rancid bit, had they sold out, or would you have done that if you were in their position, or should they have kept to the DIY roots? This argument came up with bands in the 80s, and it'll come up again when a band just rockets up and sells a million records all of a sudden. Chumbawamba was the one that happened over here with their Tub Thumping single, and a lot of people, myself included, thought they completely sold out and they'd lost all their credibility and their roots and their fans. And a lot of other people thought this is it, they're going to change the system, and it didn't really change the system. It made them a bunch of money, which, to their credit, a lot of which they gave away to unions and striking workers and people who needed the money, good on them. So they were still true to their original ideals. It's just they took this risk of seeing what would happen if they went global.
I think that's the fascinating thing, is that risk. Like you're saying, with Chumbawamba, that song took off. It was massive, and they had the second single, I guess, which did okay. But beyond that, and they tried to do it the right way. He got arrested at the award show because he joined the miners that were protesting out front, and ended up
Yeah.
getting arrested at the award show that he was nominated at. Like Rage Against the Machine is another band that tried to do it as, like, as I guess ethically, or tried to do it as in keeping with punk roots as possible, but the
Well, yeah, I mean
systems.
the lyric "fuck you, I won't do what you tell me" is not as punk rock lyric ever,
And he was like from hardcore bands, and Zach was like in Inside Out, like that was his roots as well. And it's interesting, like you said, like the temptation, like would you have done it? Because if you make that jump, you could be Green Day, but you might not. And then there's, what has that done to the
Yeah,
people that
you
liked
can't.
you?
It's hard to jump back.
Yeah, because Chumbawamba was massive prior to that, in not ma well not massive massive, but like certainly had a large following amongst sort of DIY punk people prior to that jump.
Oh yeah, they were not superstars. What's the word? They were iconic in the anarcho-punk scene because they were very different from all the other anarcho-punk bands. I guess all different from each other, but. They did things very differently, very theatrical. There were so many of them, very direct and fact-based about their political lyrics. They're very much of the moment. They sing a song about things that happened last month, whereas other writers like myself try to exclude names and reference points that set the songs at a certain point in time to make them more relevant as time goes on. Or equally relevant. Yeah, hence all the feelings that were generated when they did the tub thumping thing and signed to EMI. It was just like, you're going to sign to a record label. Don't pick the worst one, the one that you were inherently part of. There was an album came out, fuck EMI, right? A compilation album. And they were on it. And nobody knows who put it out. Well, few people know about it, but it was just generally a secret as to who put it out, so no one got sued or anything. And they were part of the whole thing. And it's just like, go to Warner Brothers, go to Disney, whatever, but don't go to EMI, the very beast that you've been slagging off in your previous incarnations. It was so non-understandable still.
And EMI, from not the birth of it, but certainly the explosion of punk in the UK, is baked in as the natural enemy of punk from the Sex Pistols.
Even though they were on EMI for a
Yeah,
while,
exactly. Yeah.
not very long, but that song was based on the fact they left EMI and took £100,000 off them in the process. So yeah, good on them, really. In that punk rock sense, they made a whole bunch of money doing one single that got banned, you know.
Yeah, but that's like the original sin that starts the war with punk and EMI. That I guess the big moment was that crossing the line by Chumbawamba to EMI.
Yeah, it was just too weird.
This happens, as you say, like, and Rancid never did. I guess internationally they're on their major label with Epitaph, but like they never left Epitaph, but they were still kind of painted with that brush at that time because there were like there
This is
was
where all the
real
divisions,
vitriol.
it all gets blurry, because Epitaph and Fat Records, come to that, they're still DIY labels. They're still run by the same people who started it in the first place on a DIY basis of putting their money into it, helping bands out, putting their records out. And the fact that a lot of their records have sold a hell of a lot of copies makes them fairly rich people. But does it make them pariahs? Yes or no? I don't think it does. I don't think it should, but it happens. People get jealous. People say it's not as hardcore as it used to be. But there again, NOFX were hardcore to a certain point, but they were also singing a lot of love songs. It was pop punk incarnate. That's what they did, that's what they do. And so they hadn't really crossed any lines. They just got successful at what they were doing. And we shouldn't really berate people for being successful if the terms on which their success is based is more or less the same as what it was when they started. Chumbawamba's success, however, was based on them joining EMI, having been on their own label. It was a complete, they'd hit all the cutoff points and gone over them into this new weird world of hoping to change the world by mixing with the enemy, basically. But your friends shouldn't become your enemy just because they made a lot of money being successful was what they're doing, if what they're doing makes them part of the punk rock DIY ethic.
I guess it goes back to like what we were talking about before. Like this is in service to punk, and if success comes, success comes. And then it's, what do you do? Do you deliberately shun that success, or do you avoid that success, or do you
It
go
depends. It
with
all
it?
depends what your starting point is. It's all about contradiction to what you've done in the first place. If you contradict yourself, you become a hypocrite, and that is selling out. And that's an easy way to work it out. I mean, bands that aim to be famous that become famous, you can't really slag them off because that's what they always want to do in the first place. Bands that say we are never going to sell out, we will always be hardcore to our roots, our shows will never cost more than this to get into, we care about the profit and where the money goes, money is the root of all evil, da 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 da. And then they go and throw all those ethics out the window because if an offer comes in from a major label, that is wrong. So it depends where a band starts from. If they contradict everything they've ever based their priorities on, then that is, it's going to piss off a lot of people, and
It's
rightly
all,
so.
but I think it's also because everyone's got their own definition of what that line is. Like,
Oh, of course they have. Yeah, exactly. That's why you can't slag off people who become rich via punk rock if, when they were starting, they still had the same moral outlook on punk rock as they have now. Now, I'm not saying that these people who make a lot of money always wanted to make a lot of money. They just didn't consider making a lot of money to be a fault. And it wasn't a fault line because they just carried on doing their DIY attitude in their music. It just happened to sell a lot of copies because it got very popular. And their notion of DIY was more expansive than other people's notions of DIY, like mine, for instance. Like, I don't think you should work with large corporate people if you can totally avoid it. Now, even the Subhumans have worked with, unbeknownst most of the time, venues, mostly in the States, who have been bought up by, what are they called recently?
Clear Channel.
Clear Channel, yes. And at first you don't know who Clear Channel is, and it gets pointed out that they're a massive corporate entity that was making loads of profit off the back of music. And we never set out to be doing that sort of thing. So that's embarrassing. But I'm not going to cover it up and say, like, it's what we always wanted to do, because it's not. You know, we never set out to be rich and famous. We don't mind making some money, but we're not going to do it at the expense of anyone feeling ripped off in the process, because being ripped off sucks. And punk rock threw away all those bits of the music industry where people were just being ripped off all the time. Hence the pay no more than on the record label, on the record sleeves. Hence the pay no more than shows, where it was like, you know, it was £1.50 to get in, when other shows were like £2, £3, or £5 to get in, depends who was playing. I'm very much aware that money shrivels people's souls. And it's also a very hard thing to get around if you haven't got any. And so if you provide records, music, entertainment, shows at a price that people can pay, so they can actually afford to get a drink as well and have a better time, then yes, do it that way. And like, don't lose money in the process, because that's just self-pityingly stupid thing to do. So make a bit of money. We can keep out the rat race. Brilliant. Go for it. But if you're going to do it at the expense of other people feeling ripped off, then you've got yourself to blame.
I think the rat race came for us in the end. There's, like you're talking about, these venues that have been bought up by corporate entities, the fact that we're all have to be on these streaming platforms now to exist as a band in this world. You have to advertise your shows on Facebook. My band's got a swear word name, so we can't even advertise ourselves on Instagram or Facebook. So, but and it screwed us for promoting our live shows, because all that infrastructure that people had built throughout that punk era of this network, DIY fanzines, these labels, this whole sort of thing, it looked really attractive to people that wanted to make money, I think, post Nirvana, Green Day, and Rancid exploding. And I think that was the bigger fear, I think, for a lot of people, was that this was going to come. Like, not that these bands were going to make more money and stuff, but that this was blood in the water for the sharks.
Yes, well put. Yeah, and this is why there's less purely DIY venues there. And that's why we sometimes end up playing venues that have recently sold out to corporations. They've got the same management, the same people go to the shows, but above the management is this beast that is feeding off the sweat of the people below it. Sometimes it feels like it's unavoidable, and that's depressing. But is that a punishment for becoming successful and well liked and popular? Not as a band, I mean, as a venue, as a scene thing that gets bought out, like especially venues and record labels, getting subsumed into the streamlined culture, mainline culture. It's an eternal argument. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Punk rock reaches more people. Is that good? Or is it bad because it's a weaker version of the ideal that's reaching more people, therefore it's taken less seriously, and it just becomes another 3-minute jingle in the people's brains rather than meaning anything that might develop some sort of societal change, which is, at the bottom line, is what punk rock would like to see, things being different. It's an old question. How far do you go before the message gets lost because you've gone too far in the hope that you gain more people to get into it and help it along the pathway towards success in terms of changing things in some sort of radical way. It's a hard one. I still think the best way to change society radically is to have kids and feed them everything you know. Be a balance between what the school and what the church is trying to tell them. But that's a long-term plan. I haven't got any kids, so I stick to the music.
But you're informing the kids, and that's the important part, because I think you do need it to get popular, because unless we're talking about massive revolution, like massive social revolution and complete societal change that way, societal change is going to come incrementally, and it's going to come. And a lot of kids that do a lot of amazing things for the last 40 years have come out of this punk rock thing, and you need to repopulate that pool. So it's almost like you need a supernova of a band getting so popular that maybe they quote unquote sell out and explode and they're no longer part of the punk thing, but that will bring more people in, and that will help populate the next generation of mental or who hear, like, you know, a band on the radio like The Clash and get inspired to start putting out tapes.
We were all of us were initially inspired by bands that were on huge labels and sold billions of records, like the Sex Pistols or The Clash. That's just the way it is. And it's because they were so in the mainstream that we got to hear about them at all. And that's why DJs started playing this stuff. And that's why bands invented themselves, because they wanted to be like that. They wanted to be like Johnny Rotten or Joe Strummer. And yeah, it's an influence thing. It carries on down, and certain bands pop up, go mainstream, and more kids then get into punk rock. Then a proportion of those kids will dig into the history of punk rock and find some stuff that means a bit more to them than, say, a jingly jangly pop punk band who got into the top 20. But that, without that jingly jangly punk rock band in the top 20, it might never have happened. It's all a mixture of stuff. We can't just sit here and curse all these bands for making it big, because that's not the argument. That is not the problem. The problem is society and everything out there. Even the fact, where do you end here? The point is, any bands doing anything that changes one person's idea about how they're existing, that's a good result. And if those bands are in the top 20 or in the bottom 20, it really doesn't make that much difference. So we can argue the toss about how bands are hypocrites for selling out or not selling out, and how many records get sold before you failed punk rock, and yada, yada, yada. Jeez, we dig ourselves into a pit. We like it in this pit. We've lived in this pit for a very long time, but we've got to realize that there is a world outside this pit that we either influence or we don't. And there's ways of doing it, and some people will do it a different way to ourselves. So in the name of anarcho-anarchy, peace, freedom, and equality, let's drop all the inner punk arguments between ourselves about ourselves and dividing ourselves up into should have, shouldn't have, all this, and just like declare punk rock as being the life savior for a lot of people on the planet, including us oldies, and including new teenage kids growing up in a society that's actually way worse than it was for us 40 years ago, who need something from outside their bubble to pop that bubble and say, hey, this is punk rock. It sounds like this, and it sounds like this. It comes from here, and it also comes from here. So here's a little nudge. Start digging, see what you find out. And that's the only way to improve society, really. This is what punk rock's all about. It's having a good time, improving things, and not fucking ourselves up in the process.
Dick, anytime you want to come back on this podcast and talk about the good, the bad, or the ugly of punk, you're always welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.